Chapter 4, Family Reunions and a Big Disappointment. My parents had separated during the war when I was still living at home. Later they were divorced and each remarried. Once I had melted into the Indian background and disappeared. For prudential reasons, I stopped writing to them. I did not want the army to be able to track me down, supposing it was minded to do so. And once I had gone forth as a homeless wanderer, I naturally thought it incumbent upon me to sever all earthly ties. It was not that I did not love my parents, but that I loved the Dharma more, and wanted to devote my whole life to it. And devoting my life to the Dharma, I had concluded, meant becoming a monk, with all that this entailed in the way of separation from society and the family. Whenever I thought of my parents, and I certainly did think of them from time to time, it was with unalloyed affection and gratitude for having given me a happy childhood. In any case, while in Ceylon, I had told them that I was thinking of becoming a monk in India after demobilization, and they had, in effect, given me their blessing. At the time, the English Sangha Trust invited me to England. I had been a bhikshu for nearly 14 years, during which period a change in my attitude to the monastic life had taken place. Though continuing to value real as distinct from merely formal monasticism, I no longer saw monastic life and spiritual life as virtually identical, which is the strict Theravadin position, nor did I any longer see monastic life as necessarily involving an austere aloofness from the world. I therefore accepted the Trust's invitation, not only because I might be able to help resolve the differences between the English Sangha Association and the Buddhist Society, but also because it would give me an opportunity of seeing my parents. My mother was living in Rayleigh in Essex, and within a week of my arrival in England, I had caught the train at Liverpool Street and was on my way to see her. She had written to me some months earlier, having obtained my address from Christmas Humphreys, who had informed her that I was expected in the country shortly. This I had immediately confirmed, thus giving her plenty of time to get used to the idea of seeing me again. Our meeting was a joyful one. I would not have been surprised if my mother had become emotional and shed a few tears, or even if she had reproached me for having kept her without news of my whereabouts for so many years. But she did neither. She simply was overjoyed to see me, and it was clear from her demeanour that the only thing that mattered to her was that I was actually there at last. She had been a widow for 3 years and lived alone, though John, her elder grandson, who was 19 and whom she had brought up, still had a room at the bungalow. News having been exchanged over a cup of tea, I gave her the presents I had brought. They included a set of 6 silver teaspoons of ornate Newar workmanship, each one of which was set with a turquoise. The following day she took me with her when she went out shopping and proudly introduced me to the numerous friends she met on the way. What they made of my shaven head and yellow robes I could not tell, for they were much too polite to show any surprise at them and behaved as though meeting a Buddhist monk in the high street was an everyday occurrence. In outward appearance my mother was very little changed. Though she had grown a trifle stout, her expression was still youthful, and her step light. But mentally there had been a change, though perhaps it was not so much a change as a development, a maturation of qualities already present in her. She seemed more confident and self-assured than I remembered her to have been. I attributed this to the fact that during the 17 years of her second marriage, she had travelled abroad a lot with her husband, an inspector of school supplies whose official duties frequently took him to conferences in Europe. Her favourite countries, she told me, were Switzerland and Austria. They were so clean. But if there had been little change in the outward appearance of my mother, the years had not dealt quite so kindly with my sister, who came to see me on the second or third day of my visit, my mother not having allowed her to come any earlier, as she wanted to have me entirely to herself for a while. Joan was 15 months younger than me, but already there were silver threads in her dark brown hair, and it was soon apparent that she was a habitual smoker. She had been a young girl when I left England. Now she was a haggard-faced woman on the verge of middle age. As my mother afterwards told me, she had led an adventurous, even hectic, life, had married more than once, had given birth to three children, and now was expecting a fourth, and for several years had lived, to my mother's horror, in a real gypsy caravan, as she had an aversion to the city, to houses, and to ordinary domestic life. She was nevertheless of a placid, easy-going disposition, as I well knew, and I gained the impression that my mother worried about Joan much more than the latter worried about herself. That same day I met John, a shy and reserved youth, as well as his 11-year-old brother David, who bombarded me with questions about India and wanted me to talk Hindu. I may also have met Joan's husband Eddie, who was 10 or 12 years her senior and whose entire working life had been spent with Ford Motors. My father was living in Southfields, not far from Wimbledon Common, in the ground floor flat of the terrace house that had belonged to my grandmother. She had lived there with Aunt Helen, my father's unmarried younger sister, and the place was hardly less familiar to me than my own home. On the outside, it was unchanged. There was the same privet hedge, the same neat front garden, the same balustrated porch, the same dark green front door with the stained glass panels, and the same polished brass letterbox, which, as a very small boy, I had loved to rattle to announce my arrival. Within, much had changed. Gone from the walls of the entrance hall were the big Chinese painting and the ceremonial swords. Gone from behind the front door the Tibetan ritual bell I had so loved to ring. And gone all the old-fashioned mahogany furniture that my grandmother had polished with such loving care. Gone even were the well-known portraits of my grandmother's two deceased husbands, and the photograph of my parents with me as a baby in long clothes that used to hang in the living room. The living room itself was relatively unchanged, though it seemed smaller and narrower. There I gave my father and his wife their presents, and there the three of us had tea. My father's present was a bowl from Bhutan, carved from the excrescence of an apple tree and lined with silver. When I was a boy, he had brought me many a curio, and it was fitting that now I should be giving him one. To his wife, I gave a set of Indian handmade placemats. No introduction to her had been necessary. She was already well known to me, and had been no less glad to see me than had my father. She was the sister of Auntie Hilda, the first wife of my mother's brother Jack, and as a girl had often acted as my nursemaid. Though my father was glad to see me, I soon observed that there was something on his mind. It related to my grandmother. I was certainly not surprised to learn that she had been dead for some years, but it came as a shock when my father told me that she had committed suicide. She had been living with them at the time, or they with her, there in Elborough Street, and one morning Florrie had returned from the shops to find her with her head in the gas oven. They had been shocked and distressed beyond words, and from the heartfelt way in which my father spoke of the unhappy event, I could tell that it still distressed him, even to think about it. I also had the impression that he was anxious I should not think that he and Florrie had neglected my grandmother in any way, or made her feel that she was a burden to them. They had done everything for her they could, he assured me. Nothing had been too much trouble. I had no difficulty believing him, as he had always been an affectionate and dutiful son. but I also knew that my grandmother was a strong-minded, independent old lady who would not have enjoyed being dependent on others, however close to her they were, and however happy they may have been to look after her. My grandmother's death had not been the only one within the immediate family. Uncle Charles, my father's stepbrother and his junior by 10 or more years, had died prematurely of a heart attack. He had inherited the Chinese painting and the ceremonial swords, together with the other curios and antiques his father had collected, which explained why they were not in their usual places. Like the rest of his estate, they were still the subject of litigation between his ex-wives. Aunt Helen had not been seen for many years. She had turned strange, as my father put it. Strangest of all, having inherited my grandmother's house, she had sold it over their heads without consulting them, so that he and Florrie had woken up one morning to find they had a new landlord. This astonished me greatly, as Aunt Helen had always been conspicuously devoted to my father, and Florrie had for many years been her best friend. Before I left, my father handed me my post office savings book, which I had entrusted to him 20 years earlier on the eve of my embarkation for India. I had forgotten all about it. But my father had not forgotten. He had religiously sent the book in every year for the interest to be made up, with the result that I now had £120 to my name. I also had entrusted to my father the various notebooks containing my poems, together with the manuscript of my novel and the 100 or more books that had not been destroyed when our house was bombed. These I certainly had not forgotten. I was looking forward to the opportunity of casting a critical eye over my early literary efforts, especially the poems. But when I asked my father about them, he looked blank. "Oh, yes," he responded at length, passing his hand across his brow as he tried to remember. "There were a few poetry books. I think your cousin Isalda took them." I was deeply disappointed.